expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And good morning, and welcome to this April 24th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, always available via podcast. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. You can subscribe there. You can subscribe on Stitcher, however you prefer to digest your podcast these days. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. We are doing both the novel and the short story form this morning. Both guests are debut writers. Lydia Fitzpatrick is on with me now, and Kim McGowan will join in the second half to share her collection, Undoing. Lydia Fitzpatrick's work has appeared in the O. Henry Prize Stories, The Best American Mystery Stories, One Story, Glimmer Train, and elsewhere. She was a Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford, a Fiction Fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Creative Writing, and a recipient of the Elizabeth George Foundation Grant. She graduated from Princeton and received an MFA from the University of Michigan. She lives in L.A. Lights All Night Long is what we're talking about. I am wild for this book. It's published by Penguin. It will drive our discussion this morning. Lydia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So if you happened to have been at Literary Orange at the beginning of April, Lydia was on my fiction panel there. So we've had the pleasure of talking twice, and that's a great pleasure.
Yeah, for me too.
So perhaps if you were there, a few things might sound familiar this morning, because I wanted to pick up on some of the threads that we got to talk about there. But before we dive into all of that, I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the novel for people who haven't yet picked it up and kind of take us into this world, and that'll set the foundation for our chat.
Great. So Lights All Night Long is a literary mystery, and it's the story of two Russian brothers, Ilya, who is a gifted academic and is tapped for an exchange program that will bring him to Leffe, Louisiana for a year of high school, and his brother, Vladimir, who is very different from Ilya. He is magnetic but drawn to trouble. And just as Ilya arrives in America, Vladimir is imprisoned for a series of murders in their hometown of Berlozhniki. And Ilya is convinced of Vladimir's innocence and determined to prove it, along with the help of his host sister in the States, whose name is Sadie.
So it's like part literary thriller, part coming of age, part immigration story, like a family story, a love story. And for all of that, it's not the length of War and Peace. So it's...
No, thank goodness.
It's amazing.
I probably would still be writing it if it were.
Yeah, right. It's amazing to have accomplished all that. So as you say, a lot of it takes place in Russia, and we got to talk a little bit about that before, and I want to kind of unpack some of that because I think it's fascinating. So it's Russia and Louisiana. And these settings are so visceral and so well drawn and seemingly different from each other. And yet then they start to sort of play off each other and echo with each other in some really interesting ways. So talk about these two places and getting them so right.
Yeah. So both of the settings are imagined. So Berlozhniki is an imaginary town in Russia's northwest, and Leffe, Louisiana is an imaginary town in central Louisiana. And, you know, I set out to have these two settings sort of exist in opposition to one another. And then in the writing of the novel, one of the great surprises was sort of finding how much they had in common. They're both refinery towns, which is a deliberate choice on my part, and they're both petroeconomies. Both regions are petroeconomies, and so you know, despite all of the natural wealth of these regions, there isn't a lot of wealth for the inhabitants of both of these towns. There's poverty, there's addiction, and then you know there are common threads in the ways that characters deal with these trials and traumas, through family, through religion. So, you know, one of the joys of moving back and forth between the settings was kind of finding out how much they did actually share. And that was a surprise in the drafting of the novel.
Yeah. So talk about your connection to Russia, because I think that's really interesting. And I feel like you almost have to have some personal connection to a setting to, you know, to kind of get it really right and to kind of get inside of it, especially a place like Russia, which feels so very not only, you know, geographically foreign, but kind of psychologically foreign to a lot of us.
Yeah, so my mom is a Russian historian, and she lived and studied in Russia during the Cold War. And when I was growing up, she was working on a nonfiction book about Russia. So Russia was very much like a presence in my house. You know, I think I was fascinated by it because it had captured so much of my mom's attention and time. And she sometimes, you know, sort of seemed to long to be there. So I did, too, before I even really knew anything about it. And then when I was 8 or 9, we had Russian exchange students who came and stayed with us. And the youngest of the two was 6 at the time, and she was a brilliant pianist. And her stay with us culminated in this duet that she performed with Rostropovich at the Kennedy Center. And she's just, you know, was an incredible performer, but also she was, you know, incredibly brave to my mind. And I was probably 8 or 9 at the time. The idea that she had left home and family and traveled halfway around the world, you know, on this adventure in search of opportunity, the idea of the pull of opportunity being in opposition to home and family, and, you know, the idea of the people and places we have to leave behind sometimes in pursuit of our dreams was striking to me, you know, as a kid. And then I think it really found its way into Ilya's character and into the novel's central conflict. And then in the mid-90s, I went to Russia with my family. I had an uncle who was living there at the time, and we stayed with him. And, you know, I knew that Russia was in the midst of a political transformation, but it was quite shocking to see the forms that took. There was a dead body in the courtyard of our apartment building one morning, and there were old men and women selling their Soviet medals at a street market, and we had a Geiger counter to measure the radiation in the food that we cooked. So there was a lot of heartbreak, but there was also this real force of hope, this idea that Russia was a place on the verge. It was dynamic, and that to me was really appealing and, you know, exciting. And so I think I became really fascinated in the country in a more concrete way in my teens. And then I took Russian in high school, and I went back again on a research trip in 2008 with my mom. You know, I started doing a lot of the groundwork that would find its way into the novel at that point.
How long were you there with your mom?
I was there in the 90s for a summer, and then when I went in 2008, I think I was there for 2 or 3 weeks on a research trip. The University of Michigan has a great program. I was in grad school there for creative writing, and they fund research trips. So I was lucky enough to, you know, to get one of those trips as a grad student.
How do you kind of know where to start? Like, your plane lands, and you've got this novel, and it's kind of still amorphous, and you don't...
So, you know, in 2008, I was actually working on a different project. That was quite a while ago. It was set in Russia, but it was sort of loosely based on my parents' experience there. So on that trip, we kind of retraced my mom's steps. Like, I visited her old dorm at Moscow State University, and I actually met some students there at the time, and one of them, you know, served as a sort of another inspiration for Ilya's character. He had moved from a town in Siberia to Moscow State University and was soon being posted at a research lab back in Siberia. And his sort of longing for home also found its way into Ilya's character. So, you know, I think that a lot of it is about noticing details and remembering them, and then when you hit a certain point in the novel, you feel it click into place. This knowledge that you've accrued, and the people that you've met, and their experiences, and their pasts, and you know, I also did a lot of research when I got back from that trip. I read political and economic histories of Russia in the 90s and 2000s, and memoirs, and Svetlana Alexievich's oral histories, which were amazing. You know, I recommend them to anyone who's not even interested in Russia, but they were really, really important for the crafting of the novel. Secondhand Time, especially, which is a collection of oral histories set from 1991 to 2012. And it gives these really intimate perspectives on the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then, you know, taken together, it's sort of this mosaic view of all the varying perspectives. So that was hugely important. So, you know, then once I've done all this research, it's it's important to me to then kind of try to push it aside and move back into the character and let it sort of bubble up, like let everything I've learned bubble up so that I'm sure that I'm coming to it from a humanistic perspective rather than, you know, a sort of top-down research perspective.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And one of the other things that you said during our talk that I thought was so useful, especially about writing about a place so far, are the use of photographs. And, you know, kind of inhabiting. In fact, I went home and looked up some of the photographers that you had mentioned that day because I was so fascinated by it. And you can really see how book research would give you a very different texture than staring into somebody's face or to look at what's on their coffee table or, you know, all those really intimate details that you can't get from a book.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, for me, setting is sort of the way into stories. And I've been really excited that people have responded to the setting so positively in the novel because it's really important to me, and it's often the way that the world and the characters kind of emerge for me from the setting. And so photographs are huge to me in inspiration and research. So Donald Weber's photos that he took in Vorkuta in 2008, and that's a city in Russia's northwest that has a lot of similarities to Berloshniki. And those, you know, those photos, I stared at them every day for the 7 years that it took to write the novel. So, you know, some of the images are to me at least, very clearly in the book. And then Emmanuel Sartoli took a series of photos. Of crocodile addicts in Russia, and so, you know, those were really, really useful to me in just making sure that I was creating a humanistic portrayal of a crocodile addict, you know, and really looking at it from the perspective of someone whose their circumstances and their choices have led them to try a drug as harrowing as crocodile.
Those photographs were so harrowing that I think they, like, censored them online. Like, when I went to look them up, and a lot of them are, you know, just, like, bubbled out like you would bubble
up. Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, when I was writing it, you could see the whole series. And then he actually, the heartbreaking thing is that he went back to do a follow-up series. And, you know, a very high percentage of the people that he had photographed had died because the life expectancy of someone who's using crocodile is 2 years. So he had a hard time finding the subjects who had been part of the first series. But, you know, maybe that's a new development that they have been censored.
I mean, that's what it looked like. And there were so many kids. There were so many, like, little kids in his photos that he was just... Hard to look at. But yeah, I mean, that really struck me as a very useful way for a writer to get into the details as opposed to get into, you know... I mean, if you're having a hard time coming up with language and description to look at a photograph, you know, I think that's a really useful tip for writers to
Yeah, and the other thing I found, you know, since it was prohibitively expensive to go to Russia every time I wanted to in the drafting of the book, I really found the street view function on Google Maps useful. So Vorkuta, which is the city I was talking about that Donald Weber photographed, it did not have the street view function for the first few years that I was working on the book. But then at some point I was looking at a street map, you know, to get a sense of the layout of the city and the names of the streets. And I clicked on a street and, you know, all of a sudden sort of swooped down into street view. And I mean, I must have wandered around cities in Russia's northwest for days and days and days. And there are so many details that you can find that way, you know, like the make and model of cars, what's being advertised in the window of the grocery store, you know, what are they selling at the kiosk, what's on sale, you know, what is the symbol used for a pharmacy, what's the graffiti on the buildings? There are just so many things that you can pull from that feature that I found it really, really useful. And you know, it's not the same as being there. You're missing out on so many of the other sensory aspects of visiting a place. But it was, you know, visually another way to find inspiration.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. So another thing that I heard you did that I am fascinated by is you were having trouble with the structure, having trouble with putting the plot together. And so you took two novels that were similar to what you were trying to accomplish, and you sort of dissected them. You did a plot map for them. And I've never thought of doing that, but kind of talk about that and choosing the novels that you thought were the right novels and kind of what you learned in the process of doing that to somebody else's work as opposed to your own work.
Yeah, so, you know, I think I have a tendency to write interiority and exposition. Those are my favorite modes of writing. And so I took two novels that actually were very light on those elements of craft. So I chose Father and Son by Larry Brown and Citrus County by John Brandon. And they're both sort of spare, and they both have a lot of forward momentum, which is something I very much admire in a novel. I love plot, and it's something that doesn't come as naturally to me. So it was really important to me that I you know, make sure I was accomplishing that, you know, that I was giving the reader that page-turning quality, because it's something that I love to find in a novel. So I took these two novels, and I broke them down in a really minute way. So I had, you know, different colored index cards for each storyline in the novel, and then I would take, like, a given chapter and have, you know, maybe 10 pink index cards and 10 green ones for each chapter and each storyline, and then I wrote down, you know, these minute plot movements, and then I pasted them up on the wall so that I could kind of see the trajectory of each storyline and see, you know, okay, in this chapter, in how many moments is such and such a storyline moved forward. And so it helped me to see, you know, how those teeny incremental developments in plot are paced, and how they're spread out, and, you know, how they're sometimes clustered. And so I found it really useful, and also just, you know, in a more general and maybe obvious way, breaking down another novel and looking at it in these little digestible bits made me feel like my own plot was a lot more approachable. And this is not to say that I then plot mapped my own novel. I wish I had, but I did then, you know, at least break down the chapters to come, like the next, I think I was usually planning like the next two chapters. And that was sort of as far in the future as I could get, but it did help me to just look at plot in a little bit like a more analytical way as opposed to a spiritual way. You know, I think there's a lot of talk about the character leading you and the muse singing to you. And so I think it was really useful for me to kind of switch off that aspect of the writing mode and try to look at it more analytically.
Yeah, so I guess you're doing kind of both at the same time. I mean, because it seems like if you know the end too much, or if it's too heavily plotted, the reader's going to sense that and kind of say, okay, I know where we're going, because the writer, I always feel like when the writer knows where we're going, the reader's going to know where you're going.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You know, I think you have to really walk a fine line. So there's this Edward P. Jones quote. I think it's from a Paris Review article, but forgive me if not. I know it's from him. And he talks about how you should always know that you're going to bring your characters from Washington to Baltimore, and that the adventure is what happens in between. And, you know, you can create a lot of tension through what happens in between, but that you should have an idea of what the starting and the end point is. And I did not for this novel. And I think that for the next one I do, and I'm really excited about that, because I think there's a lot of leeway and room for exploration even if you know the starting and the end point. You know, I think there's still a lot of things that can be explored and discovered. And, you know, the thing that we read is to discover, like, how and why. It's not necessarily, you know, the what of getting from beginning to end. It's not the what happened, it's the why. So I think, you know, knowing the beginning and the ending isn't necessarily a bad thing, as long as there's room for discovery and development on a deeper level in the middle.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Lydia Fitzpatrick, the book Lights All Night Long. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So if we haven't made this clear so far, there's really like two strands of the novel. There's the Louisiana present movement strand, and then there's a lot of backstory that takes place in Russia. And I really like that structure. I really like being able to, as a writer, being able to have kind of two different legs to stand on, and, you know, being able to shift back and forth and keeping those momentum storylines going, so that, you know, when you finish one chapter, you almost can't wait to get back to that chapter, but now you're off on the, you know, the other leg. And so I assume that you'd have to kind of separate out those two braids and make sure that they're independently working from each other. Was there a point in time when you kind of did that, where you took the book apart and just looked at one forward momentum storyline separate from the other?
Yeah, there was. So I wrote the book as it appears, alternating between the chapters. And then I got to an ending that did not work well. And at that point, I was pretty frustrated. I tried to fix the plot. The plot was an issue. And I tried to fix the plot with the chapters alternating. But ultimately, I had to separate them completely and almost look at them as two separate stories and figure out, you know, how to create arc, tension, resolution in each one independently, and then I rebraided them together. And, you know, I really like that I wrote them as they appear in the book, because I think it, you find these echoes between, you know, the beginning of one chapter and the end of the previous chapter. And it, I think writing them back and forth really helped to have sort of the, this idea of the two places speaking to each other. If I had written them separately, I think they would have felt a lot more discreet. But yeah, ultimately I had to take them apart in order to fix the plot. But yeah, I think too, I am a big polisher and reviser as I go, which is a habit that I don't recommend. But I think it helped a lot to ease those transitions between you know, the Louisiana chapters and the Russia chapters, because I had reworked those chapters and polished the movements between them so many times. And I also, for most writers, I think, you know, new characters, new places, new beginnings are given energy to the writing. So for me, moving back and forth between the two settings as I was writing them just gave an extra little jolt of energy each time I would move back and forth, in the way I hope that it does for the reader.
Yes, yes, for sure. It's so funny, because when we talked before, I think you said that when you first started the novel, this sort of, not, she's not a minor character, but this character Sadie was really the driving force behind the novel, and it really didn't take legs until Ilya entered the scene and it became his story. And I was thinking that that's interesting, that I think a lot of writers look at their book and say it's a plot problem, and sometimes it might be a character problem. It might be, you know, the story really belongs to somebody else, or the whole thing would take on a different tone if it was from somebody else's point of view.
Yeah, you know, I think that's true. I think there probably could have been a novel in Sadie and her story, and I think, you know, maybe I could have found it if I wrote probably a half dozen openings to the novel that involved Sadie as a protagonist. But I found Ilya first, and I'm really glad I did, because yeah, the second he appeared on the page, there was just this energy to the writing and this feeling almost of like the floor falling out beneath me. Like there was a depth there that I recognized instantly. And you know, that's one of the big pleasures of writing, is when you have those moments and you realize you've hit upon something big that feels right, and that feels like you have some sort of emotional connection. And you know, when Ilya first appeared, I didn't quite understand what that was. But then in developing his story, you know, the emotional resonance of it and the way it tied back to my own experiences became more apparent to me, you know, the longer I spent with him. So I think in a way that's kind of what my process is. I feel like I tend to kind of cast around a lot at the beginning and brainstorm in long form until I all of a sudden feel that sense of emotional resonance, and that's how I know I'm tapping into something that's important to me.
I also wonder if it's writing about somebody who looks a lot different than you, that if you could identify with an American girl, you know, coming of age story in a way that Ilya, who is a Russian teenage boy, would be more distant from your own biography and therefore maybe easier to access.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think a big thrill of writing too is an imaginative leap for me. I'm always drawn to characters who are quite different from me. And I don't know that it's easier, because it definitely requires a lot of research. But you know, to me the key is finding those emotional points of contact. And for me, that was, you know, the relationship between Ilya and his brother was sort of my way in. I have an older brother, and my dad died when I was young, and I was really protective of him and devoted to him. And he's nothing like Vladimir, but I still, you know, sort of found our relationship in the relationship between those brothers, and that proved really crucial. And then, you know, as in the drafting became a larger and larger aspect of the novel, until it really became to me the central mystery. You know, what exactly has gone on between these brothers, and, you know, what sacrifices have they made for each other? And that to me, in a wonderful way, really eclipsed the murder mystery.
Right. So tell me about your Calendar of Shame.
Calendar of Shame. So this is an idea that I stole from Tony Mara. We were at Stanford together for the Stegner, and he had this enormous calendar over his desk, and when he didn't reach his word count for the day, he would put a big red X on the calendar. So I started doing the same thing, and I love it because it's this enormous visual representation of all the days when you have failed to, you know, hit your goal. And it really gives you a sense of, okay, how many days am I writing? How many days am I getting to my 500 words a day count, which is my count? I think Tony's is 1,000 words a day. So he really shouldn't feel any shame. But yeah, that's proved really useful to me, because I think it's easy to sit at your desk and feel like you've done something, but then, you know, if you don't really hold yourself accountable, progress will be very, very slow.
Right. Any other advice, things that you're going to do different on the next novel, or things that that has sustained you along the way?
Yeah, no, I am going to have the plot figured out for the next novel. So the next novel, I actually sold a screenplay as the outline for the second novel. So I'm excited because I have all the plot movements there. I have the world there, and the main characters. And, you know, I'm still in the early days, but it feels like the drafting is going to go a lot more quickly this time around.
That is so cool. And tell us where we can find more about you online. I know you're on book tour.
I'm
actually
LA. Flying to Miami in a couple hours to read at Books and Books tomorrow in Coral Gables. And the rest of my events are all on my website, which is www.lydiafitzpatrick.com.
I love it. This was such a great read. I really, really enjoyed it. And I am so glad that we got to talk twice.
Thank you. Me too.
Lydia Fitzpatrick, thank you so much.
Bye.
That was Lydia Fitzpatrick, the book Lights All Night Long. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Kim McGowan will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can visit Barbara's website, Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. She has direct downloads as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. My website is Marie Stone. I've got my shows up there as well. Onward. Kim McGowan teaches in the Department of Literatures and Languages at Mills College. Her fiction is published or forthcoming in Atticus Review, Bird's Thumb, Cleaver, The Gettysburg Review, Hobart, on and on, many other journals. Her flash fiction story, Mad Libs, was just selected last week for inclusion in the Best Small Fictions 2019. She is the fiction editor at Pitt Hill Chapel. Kim's debut collection, Undoing, won the 2017 Moon City Short Fiction Award. It was published in March of 2018 by Moon City Press. And her novel, The Light Source, is forthcoming from 713 Books. We're going to talk about all of that. Kim, welcome.
Hi, Marie.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I'm getting to do so many collections and books from both from Moon City and from 713. I'm loving getting to know these small presses and all the great work they're doing and all the great writers that are coming out of these places. So cool. I want to get into that and kind of talk about how you found them and all of that in a minute. But I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the collection and talk a little bit about Undoing and kind of how the stories came together and some of the things that were on your mind when you were putting the collection together, and kind of take us into this world to get us jumped off here.
Okay, sure. So just talk about Undoing.
Yeah, yeah. Just kind of take us into the book and, you know, kind of describe some of the, there's some recurring themes and whatnot that, that seem to pop up throughout. And, you know, just kind of talk about what was on your mind as you were assembling the collection.
Yeah. So the collection is pretty bulky. It's 29 stories, and they're all different lengths. So there's a lot of flash fiction in there, and then the longest stories are probably around 6,000 or 7,000 words. And they were stories I wrote. I mean, the oldest one in the collection I first drafted when I was 20. So there were some real oldies there. But the majority of the stories in there I wrote in the last 7 years, which is when I started getting serious about writing and serious about sending stuff out again. There are two sets of stories in there that are connected, four stories about a girl named Laurel and her parents and her friend Ellie, and then two stories about a married couple, Ben and Miriam, but most of them are separate, standalone pieces. And in terms of recurring themes, I'm sure you probably have some in mind, Marie. I mean, I see it as a book about relationships.
Yeah.
And a lot of those relationships are pretty unstable. So not just romantic relationships, but also family relationships. There's a lot of dysfunctional parents in there. There's a lot of cheating spouses.
There's a lot of life, right?
There's a lot of what?
There's just a lot of life, real life in there.
Yeah. Yeah, you know the famous opening line to Anna Karenina about families, all happy families are the same, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
Right.
I feel like that's something I keep returning to as a writer.
Yeah.
And my title, Undoing, was speaking to, well, I guess the thing I like about the title is for me it has a double meaning to it. It means both things coming apart, you know, like drugs were my undoing, but also trying to repair something that's damaged, like undoing a knot. And I saw a lot of the characters in my collection as trying to do, having screwed up royally, they're trying to do repair work.
Yeah. I liked that the title of the collection is not, so often there's a short story that shares the collection title, and in this case, not so, and I really actually liked that, because I think Undoing, even though it's not a title collection in the story, you're right, it really does the work of the entire collection and really brings the whole thing together under one big umbrella, and I thought, I don't know when, at what point the title came to you for the collection, but it worked so well.
Thank you. I suck at titles.
Me
so
too.
I appreciate
Me
that.
Too. Yeah.
And my feeling about titles, short story collections that are titled after one of the stories in the collection, is it puts too much pressure in a particular story.
Right.
I mean, you know what I mean? It spotlights that story and makes that story seem like the most important one.
Yeah, right.
So actually, the first story in my collection was originally called Undoing, but when I decided I wanted that to be the collection title, I changed the story name.
Oh, that's funny.
So it's now When in Rome.
That's funny.
So and the title comes from two uses of that verb that happen in the last paragraph of the story, where the character is thinking about undoing a memory, a bad memory in the past through conjuring up this new fantasy, but also undoing the buttons of the shirt of the man that she wants to sleep with.
Right. That's so good. I really loved those linked stories, and I was wondering if you wrote them together, you know, if they were written as linked stories, or if you wrote one and then you were like, these characters just aren't leaving me alone, I'm not done with them, I need to explore. You know, because in a lot of them, you know, Ellie will be the central character, and then the next one it'll be Laurel, and then it'll be the mother. And I was wondering if you were always thinking of those as linked, you know, as four separate stories, or if 5 years later, you were like, I really want to return to these characters?
So I just wrote, I mean, not just wrote, but last fall, a fifth story about Laurel that came out in Jellyfish Review. So she's definitely a character who got in my head, and I find myself returning to, and those stories could have easily turned into a novel, except who's trying to write a novel, but how those stories began were actually in the order they appear in the book. So the first one I wrote was the Eleanor of Aquitaine story, and I was at a dinner party where people were talking about their different babysitting experiences, and someone said when she was babysitting, she used to check, outing this friend of mine, but check to see if the clients had left any pot around their house that she would then take. And I thought, that is, you know, an amazing opening to a story. I have to use that. So that was the first one I wrote. It's the first line of the story has to do with that. And one of my favorite stories, actually, I've written, it's a quiet story. It's not the one of the linked stories that people talk about the most. And then the second story I wrote was Warmer, Colder, and I wrote that within a couple weeks of the first one. So that one also came quickly. And that's a story that my writing group at the time really hated. They, it's a disturbing story. It's not a story I would ever read at a reading because I think it is a pretty unsettling story, though I think it's one of my favorites of mine.
I agree, yeah.
And then
I agree on all
the
points,
one about the mom I wrote again, I mean, within the same two-month period. So they all came really quickly. But the last one, which is separated, if I'm remembering this right, by probably 100 pages in my book, is from the stepmother's perspective, and I wrote that at least a year later.
Okay.
And that story actually took me by surprise. I was expecting the stepmother to be a more unlikable, repellent character than she ends up being, at least than I think she ends up being.
Right.
She became warmer, I think, while I was writing it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marie. I like those ones, too.
Yeah, well, which, you know, I mean, I think you're doing your job as a writer when you humanize the people that you start off thinking are going to be not villains, but not the you know, nicest protagonist. And then when you give them depth and texture and, you know, all those sympathy, you're doing your job as a writer. If she came off the way you originally thought of her, probably not as good of a story as it turned out to be.
I often feel that. I don't know if you do, too, as a writer, but that characters will take me by surprise.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly in the good stories, they do. Yeah, right. I think that's the goal. So in terms of ordering the collection, because the linked stories, two of them are up against each other in the collection, but as you say, the fourth one is separated, and I think the other two, if I'm remembering right, I'm trying to remember, there are two other linked stories, and I don't think they appear back-to-back to each other.
They're quite widely separated. You mean Brining and This Much?
Yes, right. Well, the This Much is the last story in the collection, so yeah,
right.
Those are really separated. But talk a little bit about ordering the collection, because I think that's its own challenge, you know, that the book has to stand, each story has to stand, and then the collection has to stand.
Yeah. Well, bingo, I could not agree more, and ordering the collection caused me no end of headaches. And my good friend, I think you've interviewed Michelle Ross, weighed in a lot with me. I mean, we were both working on our collections at the same time, and we talked a lot about how to sequence stories. So, and with 29 stories, it was a lot of, you know, moving parts.
Yeah.
I thought about the collection as like an album. And my thinking is that you want a first story that sort of sets up what the collection is about, And I think the first story should be pretty strong. It doesn't have to be your strongest story, but a solid story. And then the last story, I think, is also a story that needs to be, one of your strongest stories, too. And for me, should be a story that lingers. So ideally, the person closes the book and that story's in their head. And then you also need a kind of a tentpole story somewhere in the middle that holds up a lot of ballast. So those were the three things I was thinking about, like, opening story that sets up about mass, final story that's a closing story, middle story that holds up armature. But then I was also trying to mix things up, so not to have sad stories in a row, not to have too many first-person points of view in a row, not to have too much flash or too many long stories in a row. So it felt like one of those logic problems, you do in sixth grade about you have to mix up your row of racehorses.
Right, right.
I definitely put hours and hours of reflecting on what I wanted to do with sequence. And one of the choices I needed to make was whether I was going to keep the linked stories together or separate them. So, for instance, Jhumpa Lahiri's The Unaccustomed Earth.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've read that, Marie, but she ends with the four linked stories. And that was something I considered, but I liked the idea of these characters recurring, and hopefully my readers would recognize them, but it'd be a little surprised to see them again.
Exactly, right.
I did want to establish, though, with the four stories that there was going to be recurrence, so that's why I had the first two next to each other.
Right, right. So well done. So well done. So as you say, there's a lot of play between first person, second person, third person. There's flash. There's longer. There's a how-to guide. There's sort of a list. There's an email. I mean, you play with form a lot. And I was wondering if you set out a challenge for yourself or if you give yourself parameters around a story to decide, okay, I'm going to challenge myself to do second person, or I'm going to challenge myself to keep it to this word count, or to write a story as an email, or if you just have an idea and that, it kind of organically grows. But I feel like if you put constrictions around yourself, sometimes really interesting things happen.
Yeah. No, it's true. I'm teaching this flash fiction class right now at Mills, and we just read this collection, Tiny Giants by Justin Sinclair Long, where he rolled Dungeons and Dragons dice every morning, and that would give him the word count of the story.
Wow.
11 words to 88 words. I think that made my brain explode. I think that's such an interesting idea. That would make me a nervous wreck. So I don't ever sort of sit down with an experimental form in mind. I don't drive. I walk everywhere, and a lot of my ideas come to me when I'm walking. I think the stories of mine that are most formally experimental, sometimes those things have just snuck up on me. Like, there's a story in the Undoing collection called Version that got very choose-your-own-adventure on me. But it didn't start that way. I mean, initially, when I first drafted that story, it ended after the first section. And then someone in my writing group, my sister actually said to me, well, what happens next? And my thought was, well, story's over, at least from this perspective, but maybe if I picked up a different perspective, it would keep going.
Yeah.
And then it got just crazy Hydra head on me.
Which I think is an image in the story, right? Isn't there a Hydra head? There's a Hydra head.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Probably. I mean, this story ended up, that actually was the hardest story I wrote because it got so complicated when I started pursuing the choose your own adventure, because every decision led to a different fork. If you email the person, then this happens. But if you don't email the person, then that happens. I think the most experimental thing I've written recently probably was the story that's going to be in the new Best Small Fictions, the Mad Lib story. And I don't know if you read that one, Marie. It's very strange.
I tried to find I couldn't find it. I went on a hunt, but I wasn't successful.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's out there.
It was published in OK Donkey. Uh-huh. And that was another I was walking to the grocery store idea. But my idea for that story is I got obsessed with doing these 100-word stories.
Uh-huh.
And that is one of I've only managed to write two of those successfully, but I was walking to the grocery store and I was thinking, what if I tried to write a story as the Mad Lib? So had these words in it that I replaced with, you know, other verbs and plural nouns and so forth. It's hard to describe. I mean, it's
so
one
cool.
of those stories that I will never be able to read at a reading because it would sound like gibberish unless you had it on paper in front of you and could see which words were the substitution words.
Right, right. That's so cool. Yeah, I do think it's really interesting to play with these, you know, and you can only do that in the short story form and the flash fiction form. You can do all kinds of
yeah.
just weird and wacky things that, you know, obviously a novel, it's not going to work, but... it's so fun.
Yeah, it's true. It's one thing I love about flash is you can be much more experimental with it because something that would get really monotonous if you were doing a 5,000-word version of it,
right?
You have room to do in flash. I would find a long second-person point of view story pretty tiring, I think.
Right.
But I love that form in flash.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So the front of your book, so all of these stories have been published elsewhere previously. And I think for writers, the front of the book is a great way to see all of the various literary journals that there are to send out work to. So talk a little bit about submitting work and finding these journals and kind of your process of how you know which place to send things and some of your favorite independent literary journals that publish these great things?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I always used to write on the side, but I would never send stuff out because I was so freaked out by rejection. So I only started sending stories out about 8 years ago, maybe. And the original list I was working with were, you know, the usual suspects. Kind of thing, like Gettysburg Review and New England Review and Agni and all the journals that you would see, for instance, in Best American Stories.
Yeah.
And then I started getting increasingly interested in online journals. So this is incredibly anal, but one thing I started doing was checking, for instance, the Best Small Fictions, or the Wigley's Top 50, and then the Wigley's Long List,
oh, yeah.
and looking at journals that were repeats, you know, so that regularly had stories in those best of collections.
Uh-huh.
And I also sort of checked in with my friend Michelle Ross a lot. We, I think, introduced each other to a number of journals. And I started reading journals pretty widely. So you'll see it in a lot of submission guidelines that, you know, before you submit to us, you should read some issues. And I think that is actually true. I'm the fiction editor at Pithead Chapel, and we sometimes get submissions where it's quite clear that the writers have no idea what our aesthetic is.
Hmm.
And they're sending us good stuff, but it's just not... it's a horror genre or something that, you know, if they'd read an issue, they would see is probably not going to be up our alley.
Right, right. Do you do contests?
So you mean my journal or do I personally do contests?
Do you personally do contests?
Yes, I do. So this is one of the contests that I think is really fun. Is the Sixfold contest.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of Sixfold?
only through, I think, either you or Michelle.
Both of us are a little bit addicted to it. That's how I met Michelle, actually. But what is interesting about Sixfold is that it's participant-judged. I was just telling my students about this. So you submit your story anonymously. So it's a PDF without your name on it. And then the Sixfold contest happens over about 5 weeks. And there are three rounds where every participant gets assigned six stories. And you have, I think it's 10 or 11 days to read them and rank them and write comments on them. So you read 18 stories in all, and the top third advances each time to the next round, but you don't know where you place until the very end.
That's so cool.
So what's interesting about it and why I think it's a cool contest for emerging writers to try is if you get to that third round, you get a lot of comments on your stories. Something like 70 different comments.
Oh, my God. Wow. That's
cool. And they publish the top 15 fiction writers and the top 15 poets. So it's not bad percentages either for publications, and they'll probably get around 300 people, 350 participating each round.
Okay.
Anyway, I never win any of these contests except, I guess, the Moon City Press book contest.
Which was a good one.
They're fun to throw in your hat and read a bunch of stuff. And one thing I really like about the Sixfold one is when I would see writers whose work I really liked, I would give them my email address. So I'd write comments and say, if you want to show me another draft, here's my email address.
Oh, that's cool. So, yeah, it's a good way to, make contacts and kind of build a community. That's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, one thing you're ideally looking for as a writer, since writing is pretty lonely and isolating, is first readers,
right.
I think.
Someone
to send your drafts to someone whose writing you really like and who will give you useful feedback.
Right. That's so great.
I'm always doubting myself, so it's really good for me to have someone I can share something with.
Aren't we all? Isn't that part of the
I mean,
isn't that part of the gig?
It's part of how writers are wired, right?
I think so.
We're insecure.
Right. And your novel is forthcoming. It comes out in July from 7/13. That is right. We're drawing down on our time, but I also wanted to give a plug to that you have a novel forthcoming. And tell us where we can find out more about you online.
Well, I have an author website. So that's www.kimmagowan. It's magowan.com. And that has all my writing on it that's available online, which is a lot of it.
Very cool.
And interviews and reviews and links to buy both books.
I love it.
The novel is coming out July 31st and is now available for pre-order.
I love that I found 7/13 because they put out so many great books. And
They're amazing.
Yeah.
Leland is incredible. He was such a champion of independent writers, and his concept for 7/13 is it's for your first book. So he really is looking for debut writers.
It's really cool.
And actually, I think his first writer who is publishing a second book with him, but that was accidental. I mean, he accepted my novel before my short story collection was accepted.
Oh, gotcha. So the happy happenstance.
Yeah. But I love the authors, too. And so you've interviewed, I think, Jen Stroud Rossman, right?
Yeah, and Melissa Duclos. Yeah.
Oh, yes, and Melissa. So Melissa's book I'm just finishing now and is wonderful.
So good. Yeah.
Jen, I read her book a few months ago. And for me, it's fascinating, too, because it's a lot about Palo Alto in 2002, which I remember well. I live in the Bay Area.
Yeah. No, it's
really funny, wry, sad book.
Exactly.
I love that family of writers.
I do too. Oh, we're drawing down on our time, but the book is out. You have a wonderful, wonderful website, and there's really some great interviews on that website with you and Michelle, and you know, kind of the backstory of a lot of these books, and you can read more of the or backstory of the stories, and you can read more about you there. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Marie. It's great talking to you.
It was great. It was great. That was Kim McGowan. The book Undoing is out and available now, and her novel, The Light Source, is going to be coming out in July. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today, but we will be right back here with you Wednesday morning. I think Barbara's going to be on with Amy Hempel next week, so that's going to be exciting. And stay tuned for Arts and Beats coming up next, and look forward for more great programming on our website, kuci.org. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.